This is the Brian Callen Show. All right, everybody, this is the Brian Callen Show, because I couldn't come up with a better name, brought to you by the X-Flex Stand. That's right. Now that I have my own podcast on iTunes, I'm sponsored. And the X-Flex Stand is something that you can use to hold your iPad up, which I'm using right now. And it's so sticky. Just keep it away from your genitals. Okay? All right. Go to xflexstand.com. I think I make money if you do that. But that's not why I'm doing this. Because I make a fortune in other venues, like powerlifting, karate, taming lions, and selling babies. I'm drinking green tea right now, too, because they say it keeps the bugs away. Anyway, I have two very special guests, somebody I've known a long time, Hunter Motz, and his co-author, Katie O'Brien. Who's a beautiful? She's an Irish beauty. It's funny; they're good-looking people. I'm looking at, but they went to Harvard, and they're very intelligent. So they got brawn and beauty. And
Katie's and very.
I'm more the brawny.
She's very brawny. She's very, very brawny. She belongs. You belong in a field, like a field of wheat. You should just be frolicking through a field of wheat, or
harvesting it single-handed.
Yeah, or riding, or ride. Yeah. Talk into the mic when you talk, because I'm.
Sorry, fair.
No, but it's fine. But do it. Just do what I say. This is my kingdom.
I apologize for that.
And yeah, you look like you should be riding side saddle or something. But that's not what we're here to talk about. I'm actually excited about this because these guys have written a book called The Straight A Conspiracy. And what does the caption below the title say?
It's a student secret guide to ending the stress of high school and totally ruling the world.
Well, it's not just for high school students, though, because I've talked to you about this book we're going to get into it. But, I think that you guys started this book with the notion that everything we've learned about education and the process of learning is fucking wrong. And you guys went to Harvard, and I know, Hunter, you had a biochemistry degree. And you, how many languages do you speak fluently? Working languages?
Many. I'm always looking to add new languages.
But how many would you say you can, if given a month to brush up on, how many languages do you speak?
10.
You speak 10 languages?
Yeah.
And how old are you?
I'm 30.
You're 30 and you speak 10 languages?
Yeah.
And we're going to get into, I think that's impossible, but you're going to tell me why it's not.
It's not. And actually, I think that's one of the big mistakes is that, for example, when it comes to learning languages, the more languages you learn, the easier it becomes to learn those languages. Because essentially, learning a language is like any skill. There's a way you do it. And when you figure out that way, then it becomes easy. And if you think most people either know one language, two or three languages, or then you don't find people who know like seven or eight. But once they get past a certain hump, it becomes easy. And that's why when you get cultures like the Dutch, my dad's Dutch, where you're required to know French, English, German, and Dutch, all of those people have already crossed the sort of four mark, and then they just go from there.
So, yeah, you were talking about I think we had dinner the other night, and you were talking about you were learning language families.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the big breakthroughs for me is I took in high school, I took a lot of French, the usual thing, like 10 years of French, and emerged from high school basically being able to order a baguette, right?
Yeah.
Nothing actually useful,
yeah.
Right? And then what happened is that I went and I worked for the Smithsonian for a summer down in Panama after my freshman year of college and, was in this remote town. Nobody spoke English. They were convinced that there were gnomes roaming around the countryside. So I basically locked myself in a room and taught myself Spanish over the course of 3 months and then would like practice with the locals. And the funny thing is that by doing that, my French got way, way, way better.
By learning another language.
By learning a different language. That was what improved my French. And then the next year I taught myself Italian over the summer because I was working for a travel guide in Italy. And that's the thing. It's because those are all members of the Romance language family. Their underlying structure is basically the same. And we understand things not based on in isolation, but in contrast to them, each other. So you can say, verbs in this language work like verbs in Spanish, but it's different from verbs in French. And so having something to be able to test that knowledge against makes everything much stickier.
When you say you taught yourself Italian,
yeah.
What was that process?
I always buy 501 verbs. It's a series. So I bought 501 Italian verbs, and it's just like tables of verbs. And then there's a book you can get, another series you can get called the Essential Blank Grammar CD, Essential Blank Grammar Series, and it's $8.95. for a book. It's about, you know, 100 pages. It's super small.
Can you download it on a Kindle?
You can. I don't know if you can get it on Kindle, actually. No, you probably have to buy it. Old school. Printed paper. Trees must die for your improvement of your brain.
There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Chop a tree down, I'll get smarter.
But it's like $8.95, and that's the thing. I just like read that and reread that. And then I was in Italy, so I had the opportunity to speak with people. But you just find it gets easier and easier and easier to do these things. And so now I, you know, wanted to, I'm going on a trip this summer to Europe. And so I decided rather than trying to learn German, why not learn the Germanic languages? So I'm doing Dutch, Afrikaans, Danish.
I like the way you said Afrikaans.
Afrikaans.
I'm going to learn Afrikaans.
Yeah, by a goed.
Because I'm always using my Afrikaans.
All the time.
God, it's always, it's such a problem with all
my Afrikaans. Well, listen, when you watch Blood Diamond, it just really, like, really gives you another experience of
it. If you want to exploit entire peoples, you
it
need
is the language of, I'm going to get in trouble for this in like 20 years, it is the language of racism.
Oh, God, I'm not going to touch that one. Yeah. Although, you know, they did have a problem with that whole thing, apartheid. Katie, you, I know why Hunter started writing this book. And you went to Harvard and you studied British and American literature.
Yes.
And then you got into, you're now an actress. Mm-hmm. Hunter, you're an actor, it bears mentioning. But very smart actresses and actors. And you live in you live in a town where that just doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
But Katie, what got you to write this book with Hunter?
Well, it's funny. So during college, while I was sort of, you know, studying a lot of literature and specifically dramatic literature and, you know, completely always planning on being an actress, I, on the side, spent a lot of time teaching students, high school students, middle school students, first theater and dance, and then that kind of expanded into other subject areas, and it was just kind of this secondary passion.
She's such a hot teacher. I just have to. I wish we had a video. My God, I could never.
Hot brawny teacher.
Exactly. A hot brawny teacher. She's not brawny.
None of this is true. And so coming out of college, it was just tutoring as a sort of support the acting career job in the first few years. Was a natural progression and, you know, something that I love to do.
And you learned about, you watched how people learn and how they don't learn, it sounds like.
Absolutely, and both from working in a classroom and also just working so much one-on-one with students. And Hunter and I started this tutoring company together, along with two other classmates of ours from Harvard.
What is this book about? What is this book? Tell me.
Well, this book came out of that tutoring experience and seeing over and over students having the same issues in school and yet each feeling like they had a very specific individualized problem that could never be solved, such as, I don't have an ear for languages, which is what I think, you know, if I had met Hunter when I was in high school, I would have thought he was some like freak alien language learner,
but now I know
that's not specifically why.
Right. Because he's got big eyes, big expressive eyes. He's a sexy alien. And he's got cow eyes and a full head of fucking cow hair. You know what that means.
I don't know.
I like that my voice is getting all kind of sexy.
Yeah, it is, really.
Yeah. I'd be a great teacher. All right. First thing I want to do is get the boys out of my fucking class. God, you're such a pervert. I'd get fired immediately. Anyway, keep going.
So we saw this over and over, and all these kids think that they have these unsolvable problems. Like, I just didn't get the math gene. You know, it'd be like sitting in a tutoring session, and the mom would walk through the room and say, oh, it's not his fault. We just don't have the math gene in my family. And
you hear this all the time, and I just use it. I just said you're both very smart. Hunter, I think of you as a very smart guy because you can talk about science, you can talk about languages, you can talk about everything. You are a highly educated guy, especially in this town. You're hyper-educated. But you're smart. You're very smart. You always have been. And I'm sure the same goes for you, Katie. But we use this. And when I look at you and I think of you as having a bigger brain. I do. Now, you may, by the way, you may have a better computer up there. I think that some of us are born. You would say that's heretical. I mean, you'd say basically this book is challenging the supposition that I grew up with and most people grew up with, which is the idea of some people are just better at this than others. And that's my proclivity. This is your proclivity. Notice I'm using big words. That's my talent and this is your talent. But you guys say, no, learning is very much connected to the emotional state you're in when learning and context, emotional context, what's put around learning. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's all about the work that you put in. And so a lot of our book, what it deals with is how much of the learning process for other people is unseen to you. And so it's easy to make those kinds of comparisons.
So in other words, there's a mystery to learning until you see that there's actually, until you break it down as into a system.
Well, it's like if you, okay, if you go to a basketball team practice, you can see your best friend take 30 extra layup shots every day after
it's
practice
repetition.
When it's over. So you're like, oh, I can see what he's doing. So if he's better at that than I am, I can tell that's why. Because I saw him put in that
So
practice.
Yeah, you guys create a sort of a paint-by-numbers approach to getting better at something.
Yeah, because if
and
you...
And that's, I mean, that's the amazing thing is, you know, Anders Ericsson, who's the guy who is the sort of the figurehead of the 10,000 hours thing, like that was his thing. You know, I mean...
For those of you who don't know, 10,000 hours, Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called The Outliers about this as well, which is it takes 10,000 hours to really master something. And he takes the Beatles... Mm-hmm. He takes Mozart, he takes a number of, you know, great sort of even Bill Gates and seminal thinkers and people that made a huge difference in the way we live our lives and isolated, or at least argues that they had about 10,000 hours of practice at what they did before they became what they were.
And the other thing is that Anders Ericsson specifically says it's 10,000 hours of a particular kind of practice, right? So most people, when they practice, like, for example, a musical instrument, they just sort of, like, want to get through the piece. Right?
Yeah, they say a practice makes permanent, but perfect practice makes perfect, you know?
And so, you know, that's the
I'm
thing.
So fucking smart.
Brian just bent a spoon with his mind, by the way.
Thank you. Don't tell them that. Don't. I already have my fans already love me enough. I don't want to start a cult. Or do I?
Do I?
Keep going. X-Flex stand, by the way. Brought to you by the X-Flex stand. As I hawk product on my fucking show. Keep going.
But it's a very specific kind of practice. And when you look at that kind of practice, it's really the same across all fields. So to become an expert in being a piano player or, you know, doing your high school math or learning a bunch of languages, it all works in the same way. And essentially, it's really about mistakes. You have to focus on your mistakes, figure out what went wrong, and then use that to change the way that you do things.
You know, most of us, though, are taught that mistakes are a sign of weakness. I mean, mistakes are what people can't stand, you know.
And that's the...
This is sort of what we found in working with all of our students and from among our peers is just that... Especially in school, when you're making mistakes, everyone has this tendency to jump to a place of, I'm not good at this, my brain is somehow not as capable in this area. And so hiding from mistakes, shoving them away in your folder, putting your bad test grade in your bag before anyone sees it, is the first thing that people do, and that's exactly what is the least helpful for making progress.
I always think about this stuff when I see inner city kids, you know, and especially black kids, you know, though this is all, you got to be careful, don't be too, I don't believe in being politically incorrect. I remember reading Malcolm X's book, By Any Means Necessary, and one of the points that he brought up was interesting. He said, if you look at what black people have done in the areas they've been allowed to excel at, music and sports, look at how innovative they've been. Look at jazz. Look at the great jazz geniuses, Louis Armstrong and Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. And their only expression in a deeply racist world was their horns. You look at Ali, you know, the character he displayed in the ring and the leader he was just with his body, but also his mind. I always think about these things in when I want to go into these inner cities, and it's not just black people, it's whoever it is in what you'd consider ghetto poverty mindsets that can happen in East Asia, that can happen in parts of Africa, that can happen in parts of the United States. And, you know, that's why it seems like a book like yours is so fucking important to show people who have been where it's been ingrained in them that they are a second class citizen for whatever reason, that in fact you as a human being have as much potential as anybody who you thought was totally out of reach. Because we all do this.
Yeah.
I always consider myself bad at business, just okay at math, not good at being a rational thinker. My strength is more in being a silly goose. We define ourselves. I mean, I do all the time. At 45, I know. I look 30. I know. But the point is,
it's 28. Max.
Thank you. I have very tight fitting skin. But the point is that, you know, and I've been fairly successful, or really successful, which is why this is the biggest podcast of all time. There are probably 3 million people listening right now, and we're not even fucking streaming. This is in my mansion.
Just outside that window.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Fucking hot in here, by the way. Hold on.
Brian just took off his shirt.
Yeah, I just took off my shirt. And here come the pants. What was I saying?
You're just talking about...
Well,
like,
you're right. What you were saying is exactly what the point of writing this book was for us, which is, and that's why we called it the Straight A Conspiracy, is because it really is that, you know, it's centuries and centuries of myths about how geniuses that we all know got to their amazing accomplishments, and also just this everyday talk of like, oh well, I'm not a math person, so you know, and people have
it's a belief system. We have
it's so
we have not to sound too new age, but we have limiting belief systems.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that's also, you know, part of the thing is when you start to use words like emotions and belief system, I mean, I start to feel like we're going to break out like the, you know, the sage and the incense and like
exactly.
have like a hippie prayer circle. And that's the point. This isn't like hippy dippy. I mean, if you when we talk about emotions, we're talking about it from a neurological context, because the thing is that, you know, most people will talk about their emotions, but they can't really define for you what is an emotion. Right. And specifically, it's a particular state for the brain and the body, right?
Okay.
In the sense that, you know, for example, when you experience fear, blood rushes to your legs. The blood flow in your body is actually changed, right? When you experience anger, blood rushes to your hands.
No, to my groin in my case. I don't know why. I attack my groin. I call it my rifle for obvious reasons. But keep going. When you're angry, blood rushes to your
hands.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when you're scared, blood rushes
to your legs.
Wow. Okay.
And so the thing is that even, for example, when you're afraid, what happens in your brain is that there's a little thing in your brain called the amygdala, which is a small almond-shaped deal, and basically it fires up and it shuts off your attention. So when people say, I was so scared I couldn't think, that's literally true.
Yeah.
And so
they stop using the frontal cortex
that's
of the
right.
brain. It goes into their sort of midbrain, their lizard brain.
That's right.
Flight or fight.
That's exactly
know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, for a lot of these kids, if you're a kid who's intimidated by math and you're sitting in math class, your ability to think is shut down for an hour. But the kid doesn't understand that they're having an emotional experience, and they emerge from the class and they're like, all these other people understood it and I didn't. And so it validates this theory, but really there's just a cause that you haven't really understood. And it's just it's fear.
You know, Malcolm Gladwell in his book, The Outliers, which I recommend to people, compares, like they say, well, Chinese people are good at math. There was a stereotype. Well, not all Chinese people. There is a section of the population that is good at math. Well, why? He took a look. Well, what he found was that the parts of China that were good at math, the students that were good at math, came from rice farming cultures. The reason is when you farm rice, it is labor intensive. You're out there 365 days a year. And you better know math, because the amount of water that is required, the plot of land that you have to carve out, dealing with irrigation, all the things you have to take into account when planting a small plot of rice requires not only a lot of mathematical foresight, but tremendous fucking work and attention to detail. So when they're given an equation... It's just work. That they weren't afraid of work. For me, I'd see like calculus and I was like, dude, I don't have time to stare into this book because I got a lot of blood rushing in my dick. I mean my groin. I meant my groin.
Right.
And that's
must have been hard for you.
It's very hard for me. Well, look at my jawline. Look at how deep and expressive my eyes are. Women love me.
Right.
What about context. I mean, a lot of the problem with math for me was that you had me in a room where I actually ended up getting good at math because I started equating it to being manly, because my dad was good at math, so he kind of somehow inadvertently got me thinking that if I wasn't good at math, I was a girl, because my dad would be like, look at the women in the family, they're not mathematical, they're just flighty emotional chicks, and I was like, not me, I'm gonna learn math so I can learn how to think. Once he put it in the context of when you're making a point about, you know, a political point of view or whatever it might be, you've got to be somewhat methodical and logical, and you've got to be mathematical about getting your point across. Once he did that, I went, oh, that's why I should learn algebra and geometry and calculus.
And
but what about the fact that we're in classrooms? It's very hard to make math fun.
Well, but see, that's the thing is, if you look at like the experience of fun, there's a guy, Mahali Csikszentmihalyi, right?
Read his book.
Flow, yeah. Right?
Yeah, great book.
And so flow is that experience of being in the zone where you're totally engaged in a task. And there's this great diagram that he has, which you can find on Wikipedia, if you look up flow. And essentially, that state of total engagement exists when people have high skill and high challenge.
They call it, it's the same thing as being in the zone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the thing is that, you know, you have to have a certain, your level of skill has to be appropriate to the challenge, and you have to be good enough to be able to really get into that stage. And the thing is, most people just never have that experience of flow with math. It doesn't mean they can't. Mm. They can. They absolutely can.
Well, but certainly if you see these higher level mathematicians who are dealing in theoretical math, the guys who win the field medal, the answers are 357 pages long.
Right.
I mean, it, you know, so you can see that. But I know that they've done a lot of studies on flow with rock climbers, chefs, artists, painters, surgeons, and different and conductors, those kinds of things take intense concentration, but also total immersion. You know,
but that's the great thing is that like if you think about when you do stand up, right, and you have that experience, you don't have to like struggle your way into that. You just sort of,
you know what, man, I've been doing stand up for almost 20 years now, and I was just talking about this the other day. I was in Miami. And that's my favorite place to perform, but I love Canada too. All due respect to Canada because they're great. But Miami, man, I had a show, and I'm telling you that I was on stage for about an hour and a half, and I remember not having to do anything. I was watching myself, and shit was coming to me, like new jokes were coming to me in full form. Like I was literally watching this dude tear that room up, and it's what I had always envisioned. And once a year, maybe you get a show like that where you're out of your own way, man. There's this book 10-Minute Toughness where he says he has baseball players say look away, go away. No, relax, look away, go away. Get out of your own way, man.
Yeah,
and, you know, and then let trust whatever it is. But that does come from a lot of practice.
And you know, if you've got, like, if you imagine, like, having the experience, lots of people do stand up and they're terrified, right? And that's the thing. If you're terrified of that thing, then you never get to hit that flow. But it's the fear that's getting in the way of you getting to the fun.
You were damn good the first time you ever did stand up, by the way.
Oh, go on.
You actually were. You were outstanding. But yeah, I hear you. You're right. It takes practice.
But yeah, and that being said, I mean, you're clearly an expert at this point, or what is the level that's more than expert? Because that's obviously what
a master.
There we go.
I think you're looking for master.
But in the meantime, you know, that's where people are who, you know, we're trying to reach are far from that point, and really just needing the help to even get started. And so I think, you know,
how do you get started?
What we did is we really went through after this initial explanation of here's the entry-level way to understand how your brain actually works so that learning is straightforward. Then we went through all the school subjects and broke it down so that in the same way that we're talking about these rice farmers where you're just used to, it's a process, you go through it, it's no big deal. So then you see a math problem and it's a process and you go through it and it's no big deal. We did that for all of these subjects.
So you're kind of taking the fear and the mystery. Absolutely. And
we're
and
taking the magic out of school. It's just a thing that you do, and a million bajillion people from all of history have done this.
You said something, Hunter, you talked about the magical thinking and how destructive it is. Explain that. Yeah. We were talking about it because, you know, you hear all the time, we all say, and we can all be rational people, but I say it all the time. I'm not a superstitious guy, but I'll say things like, well, he's got a gift.
Right.
And we just chalk it up that he's got a gift. Because you see some kid, yesterday I did a charity for this wonderful foundation called Starlight Foundation, which helps critically ill children. And this kid who had leukemia is now cured, was playing the sax 4 years. And he played with Dave Koz, who is like, you know, the great. By the way, I'm an asshole. I walked up, I go, oh, I'd been talking to him all night. I go, you play the sax? He goes, yeah. I go, I'm taking drum lessons. That's what I said to him. Yeah, I'm an asshole. But anyway, 7-time Grammy nominee. But this kid for 4 years he'd been playing and he's amazing. And we were all saying he's such a gifted guy. Look, he's got the gift, he's got the thing. And so we all talk about this. And explain how you kind of disagree with that kind of thinking and talk.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. 400 years ago, if we saw a flash of lightning outside, we would explain that in terms of magic, right? You know, 300 years ago, if someone got sick with smallpox or something like that, we would explain that in terms of like some sort of curse or demon or something like that, right? Now we have clear rational explanations for how these things happen. If you suddenly came in here and you say lightning just happened by magic, right, we would think it was crazy, right? In the same way, if you were like, oh my God, you know, I have the flu, like I must have been cursed by some sort of witch, we would think you were crazy. And that's the thing is that essentially we figured out why do these things really happen. And we're now at a stage where we figured out why does intelligence really happen? Why do some people get stuck? Why do some people go on to do great things? Why do some people enjoy it? Why are some people intimidated? And as we are able to unravel like cause and effect, why do these things happen? Then one of the great things is we get to democratize that process of being smart, and we get to share that with everybody.
Mm. So you're saying, you're taking all the mystery out of it.
That's
so
right.
Explain to me how your mind works when you're first learning something.
Well, when you're an amateur and you don't really know, right, you really have nothing to be able to anchor your experience in. You can't relate it to anything. You're totally lost. You don't have anything to anchor your process in, right? And so there's just a process of sort of messing around, right? Usually what then happens is that people then get good enough that they start to feel like they start to change their self-image and they start to say, oh, wait, I could be good at this, right? And then the practice becomes more disciplined.
That's what happened to me with stand-up. I couldn't believe I could do stand-up. And I mean, it took me a long time to believe it. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? I couldn't believe I was doing it, you know?
And then, you know, then you start to do it in a more disciplined approach. And then essentially your practice just becomes better and better and better and better. And then rather than sort of sweeping over large areas where you have like, you know, a rough, poorly done routine, you start working on like which, you know, you get specific with like this word, this joke, like
all
that sort
of stuff. So how, what is the mindset one should take then when setting out to learn something? What would you tell a child?
Accuracy. The most important thing is like you can do it. You have to have like the basic faith in your intelligence. Like, yes, I can do it. And the issue is never my intelligence. It's the way that I'm approaching it. And then figure out exactly what has gone wrong and fix that.
I learned a little bit about what it means to be educated because I would spend a lot of time. I spent years going to the Great Courses. There's a website called The Great Courses. And I'd listen to countless courses. Mm-hmm. And what I started to realize was that there is a system to education. Academics all have the Greeks under their belt. They've got the Bible. They've got the Old and New Testament down in as far as how it affects almost everything for the next 2,000 years.
Right.
In that most literature, most great literature references that most of the people writing that had at least been what had certainly been immersed in a lot of it. So it permeates everything, the stories and everything else. So if you went to the Bible and then you went to Socrates, Plato's dialogues, Aristotle, and then you could almost jump all the way to the Renaissance and learn about, you know, I mean, you had to understand why Newton and Gutenberg and Galileo and Copernicus, what roles they played, and I guess Francis Bacon and things like that. And then you look at the great ideas of philosophy. But what I found was that there was a system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a system. You know, there were seminal thinkers that sort of brought everything to bear. And that was really an eye-opener for me. It kind of took a lot of the mystery out of people who were so academic and so smart. And I thought to myself, well, I could do this if I just put the time in.
Well, and it's,
am I right about that?
Yeah, well, and also, especially with history, for example, a lot of it is about the big ideas. There are four or five big ideas in history that you can use to make sense of almost any historical period. And when you are using those big ideas to make sense of what is happening, suddenly it becomes memorable.
Give me an example of that.
For example, food surplus. Like Jared Diamond wrote this book called Guns, Germs, and Steel. Right. And the idea is basically that...
Excellent book, by the way. For you guys, you should all read that book. You won a Pulitzer Prize. And it really takes a look at the history in the past, I think, 13,000 years.
Yeah.
And how important it is to go all the way back. But anyway, yeah.
But essentially, the thing is that, you know, if you think about something like building the pyramids, right... That requires a lot of people to not be growing their own food, right? They're basically to be able to spend all day moving large blocks around the desert purely for the amusement of the emperor and so he can feel like he has, you know, an afterlife.
Or aliens, according to Joe Rogan.
Keep going.
But and so that's the thing is that that wasn't possible in the early stages of history because people didn't have enough food to – they had to spend all their time producing food for themselves, right? And so if you try and understand, okay, why did certain parts of the world develop technology first rather than others? And it's because essentially of food surplus. So in Europe, they had access to pigs, sheep, goats, horses, wheat, barley, rye, all the big food crops they had, right, before the Middle Ages. And so what that meant is there was enough surplus food around that they could basically have things like scientists who could invent things. You have to have someone like Newton, he has to be able to spend all day in a shed.
Not in the field
growing
just trying
his own
to etch out a living.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And if you look at so much, like, for example, why does Egypt, you know, rocket ahead of everybody else so early in history? It's because they had the Nile River, right? And when you have the Nile, you suddenly can grow all this extra food, and that's why you get to have the pyramids. But it's again, it's the same idea. It's not that the Egyptians are like some magical creatures. No, they had extra food. They had leftovers.
Yeah.
You know?
And they domesticated cats, and they're magic. That's very interesting. Yeah, that's
like it's big ideas like.
There's
that.
A William McNeil wrote a book that I read called The Shape of European History. It's a short mm-hmm. book, but it talks about how important certain inventions were for pushing certain like the invention of the stirrup, mm-hmm. certain knots for sailing that allowed people to sail further. All those kinds of things. The crossbow, which rendered knighthood obsolete overnight because mm-hmm. it could pierce armor. All those kinds of things. A lot of them were war. Weapons of war. My comedy, for example, which has really thrown comedy
almost
leaps and bounds.
Well, more than just comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if we look at like the burgeoning global peace.
Thank you.
We can really.
You're talking about my piece? My piece? Or... No, I don't know. Oh, you mean peace. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I never really know.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but that's the thing. Those kinds of details, those kinds of big ideas are the kinds of things that you don't necessarily get in a history classroom.
Why don't we teach these things? What happened? Is it just bureaucracy?
Well,
Hunter has a rant about
Well, that there it's actually very there's a book called Lies My History Teacher Told Me. And you know, it's a great book. Among mm-hmm. other things, like I love that book even just for the one line, right?
Lies My History Teacher Told Me.
It's a good book. I mean, the line in particular that I love in it is that emotion is the glue that makes history stick.
Oh, and that's interesting. Say that again.
Emotion is the glue that makes history stick.
What do you mean?
Well, the point is that like when you hear a story about how, for example, you know, Caligula tried to make his horse consul, you will like never forget that.
That's right.
Crazy, right? And that's the thing is those weird anecdotes that, you know, the funny, the disgusting, the lewd, that's the stuff that you remember.
Yeah.
And most people never have an emotional experience of history. They experience it rather than as like a bunch of, you know, really fascinating stories. They experience it as like a dry series of facts
that are really
boring. And there's no connection.
Mm-hmm.
You're not connecting
right.
to my reality.
You finish, you move on, you think that there's no overarching.
Yeah.
Right.
And that, and you know, the problem is that in order to connect up those facts, you have to have a story, you know? And if we start to, like, for example, if you write the story of American history, the problem is that's going to have a very particular bias or slant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly right.
And so what happens
So people are very careful.
The only way that you can write a history textbook is to make it a series of, you know, unquestionable, you know, inoffensive, dry, boring
facts.
I always
tell people, if you want to learn about, say, the history of Israel, read Exodus by Leon Uris. Read Trinity. Mm-hmm. If you want, I mean, read Dominic Lepierre and the other guy's book on Freedom at Midnight to learn about the partition of India. That's really the way you should learn history, in novel form. And if it's got bias, so fucking be it. I'm so sick and tired of how we've been neutered by these politically correct or just special interest groups of political groups, people who have an agenda. I understand that they want a voice, and I understand they don't want to be characterized as Redskins or whatever it might be. I'm just, you know, I get it. I'd probably be the same way. But I think that we pay a price when we're not allowed to have, when a teacher's not allowed to have a very strong point of view.
Absolutely. And that is a problem that's going to take a long time to fix. What we're trying to do in the meantime is encourage individuals you know, we're saying to kids,
I don't think it's going to take a long time because you guys are writing a book like this and we're talking about
it. Well, it's about taking that challenge on for yourself then. Rather than waiting for a book to come out that's more interesting, go find that information.
And once again, the book they wrote is called The Straight A Conspiracy. And I know I'm going to get a lot of people who are asking about it. When can we get this book? Because I have a copy now.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
In 2 weeks.
If you're not Brian Callen, you have to wait 2 weeks.
That's right. Brian Callen already has a copy.
See that? I will be holding private readings in my drawing room.
Holding a snifter in one
young,
hand and
young
a book
girls
in the other.
Only, please. Exactly. petting a Persian cat.
Yes.
In fact, I'll read it back to you, Katie O'Brien.
Excellent. I can't wait.
Yeah.
As Katie, mows an entire field.
That's right. Right. That's right.
With his brawny arms.
No mowing. Just picking daisies and frolicking. while I supervise from horseback.
I mean, you know.
Another of history's big ideas.
I just shot I don't know if you've ever seen my stand-up thing where I talk about rescuing a bunch of women on horseback, and I'm eating a peach and I'm wearing a loincloth and it's so stupid. Well, Comedy Central in a TV show called Mashup that's about to hit the way they took my stand-up and they put it into sketches. Mm-hmm. So I was out in the middle of Ventura Farms. It was cold as shit. I got a cold. I'm in basically a tiny loincloth with an axe splitting wood, feeding women peaches off a stunt horse. And it was so ridiculous.
This is my life.
Yeah, literally.
This is my job.
I said, man, are you guys going to have me naked at night? It's so cold. He goes, yeah, I'm not the one who wrote the piece, bro.
Yeah.
So I lived out my fantasy, and it was not what I was not. What I thought it'd be.
Your next piece of stand-up will be about sitting comfortably at home. And
damn right.
Fireside yeah, chat. Yeah.
Man, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It was crazy. Be careful what you wish for. But keep going. I'm sorry.
When we're working with kids and we see them struggling with history, we just say to them, we're like, look, your history book is what, 300-400 pages long. And how long has history been happening for? Kind of a long time. So clearly the things that made it into your history book have to be what everyone for centuries has deemed to be the most important, the most fascinating highlights of anything that any human has ever done ever.
Yeah.
Right? So if you go in with that assumption, then you know that even if you're not getting it in this particular textbook, you can go find it. You know what I mean? So rather than waiting for somebody to excite you about history, take it upon yourself.
Yeah,
go
somebody explained history to me. The reason I majored in it is that I remember they just broke it down as a study of change over time, but also the notion that individuals are who make history, ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ideas, and sometimes they're very bad ideas, you know.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
They can.
But that's fascinating as well.
People.
And you know, even for example, like the idea that some people are just better than others. I mean, that's the point. Like we're talking about it in terms of intelligence, but that's an idea that is thousands and thousands of years old.
It's what totalitarianism, what fascism, what communism was all about. I mean, you know, speaking of history, if Hitler had gotten into the Vienna School for the Arts, history might have been very different, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But he couldn't paint human figures, and so he ended up not getting in.
One wonders
being,
why that was the big gap in his.
Yeah, how interesting. Oh, you don't know how to paint a human.
Humans.
Oh, you don't know how to draw a human. Oh, okay. Well, I'll just kill 6 million plus of them and start a war that kills 50, 60 million. I was thinking about something the notion that, and this isn't my idea. This is a historian whose name escapes me, but. The idea that you could perfect human beings, you could mm-hmm. create utopia on Earth, is really why you had people like Mao who decided not only to and Pol Pot, let's have these re-education centers.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that we can't change, those intellectuals that are already spoiled, they have to die.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's in the name of fixing humanity, perfecting humanity, that's really what's led to, I don't know, countless graves, countless heartbreaks in the 20th century alone. That notion, those dangerous ideas that human beings can be perfected, an obsession with purity. It was a form of fundamentalism, which we see in some parts of the Middle East now, that I think is going to run its course. But and it sounds like your book is challenging those assumptions. Your book is taking the magic out of purity. It's taking the magic out of the notion that some people are just inherently better than others. Mm-hmm. So that's what I love about the idea of the book. You know, I can't wait to read it because it seems that in a world that is becoming more and more democratic and closer knit and where it's harder and harder to lie,
mm-hmm.
Where politicians are really are really held to what they say more and more, and in fact are more and more responsible, having to be responsible to the to market forces. So you got a guy like Hollande in France who says, "I'm going to tax the rich 75% of their income." Well, until your rating goes down, until you know, well, let's see what the markets say. The markets will determine that, my friend. It seems that your book is really timely, and it makes sense that it would come out now because and it's much needed. Mm-hmm. I really am curious to see in 20 years, as you have scientists in India talking to scientists in Russia via Skype, etc., sharing ideas. I want to see what exponentially happens to our world scientifically, consciously, and you guys are part of that push.
Well,
it seems
we're making an effort to really poise kids for the start of a new wave of what it means. I mean, our educational system right now is set up to make you really awesome for the Industrial Revolution and hasn't really been changed since. And right now we're we're moving more and further and further into a learning-based society where you need to be able to have nothing on it and just acquire new skills as they come up. I mean, fields begin and end every day. Things are shifting so fast now, and with that connectivity, with globalization, with all of these things, the most important thing that you can possess in the coming years is an ability to learn anything.
Well, an ability to adapt quickly.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right.
You're
and to have
that
no
all the time,
hesitation on that.
Yeah, because the business, you know, a lot of people's livelihoods are challenged by the fact that you're not needed anymore.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You're just obsolete.
And that's the thing, is are you just done when that happens, or do you pick yourself up at whatever age and say, all right, what's next?
Well, you
and,
better,
embark.
Otherwise you're not going to eat.
Exactly.
So this book seems like a great, that's how you should market this book too. I mean, I wonder if, but it sounds like your book isn't just for high school students. It sounds like it's for people.
No, I mean, I think the bonus of it is that it's written to a sort of disgruntled 14-year-old boy in that it's like extremely approachable. It's sarcastic. It's fun. It's full of like cartoons, you know. At the same time, many people our age, older, everything, keep reading it and saying, oh, I needed this in school and I need it now. And this is exactly, you know, what change I need to make.
It's great, man. I can't wait to read it, man. How long did it take you guys to write this?
10,000 hours.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we graduate.
Your lifetime, actually, right?
Pretty much. That's a lot of this actually comes out of our own experiences in high school because, you know, I mean, yeah, we went to fancy schools, but I went to fancy schools. I mean,
Harvard.
Oh, yeah. We both went.
Yeah. Where, you went to schools before that.
Yeah, I
went to tuxedo school before that.
What is that?
I went to Eton.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, with Prince William.
I didn't know you went to Eton.
Prince William was in the year below me, and
did you know him?
I knew him marginally. I once had to because I was a prefect my last year, and so I had to tell Prince Harry off once, which let me tell you was like I felt like the American Revolution was complete in that moment.
Holy shit, man! Eton.
Yeah.
Eton is, for you guys who don't know, Eton is a very prestigious boarding school in Great Britain in England. Where is Eton exactly?
It's near Windsor, so
which is about 40 minutes south of London.
It's just outside of London.
Yeah. Worry about my natural notion of British geography, ladies and gentlemen. Fucking, is there anything this kid doesn't know? I refer to myself as the kid, by the way. Keep going.
You and Billy, right?
Yeah. Obviously.
But I really thought of myself as a math science person in high school. But I like had a horrible experience with English and history and writing and all of that sort of stuff. And so much of that is because we're taught to think that there are basically two ways of being smart.
That's
right.
I am. I was. Right. There's mathematical minded and there's, you know,
literature.
Yeah.
And
I'm artsy versus I'm mathy.
Right. And that's the point that sets both sides up to fail.
We have such strong, I mean, I'm just taking an inventory of my own mind and my own belief systems and stuff. We have such strong, lines that are sort of drawn around, you know, how we define our own intelligence.
Absolutely. And the more you start to think about this, the more ridiculous you realize some of those theories are. Like, you know, plenty of adults who are like, oh, I'm just really bad at working with PCs. And you're like, what? Do you really think that you're naturally, how can you be naturally bad at working?
It's so weird because I'm now realizing I constantly say, well, intelligence is compartmentalized. Some people are really smart at this. And I say this all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I talk about that in terms of courage as well. You know, mm-hmm. a guy can fight four guys in a bar, but they can't quit a job they hate. You know, there are a lot uh-huh. of examples of that. Yeah. Now that may be true emotionally, But I guess that my thinking needs to be revolutionized.
Well, this is sort of what inspired the conspiracy aspect of the book, is that, you know, people put so much of it on themselves, like it's their fault, but also to some extent you've been ingrained with this, you know, this way of thinking for so long that you don't even realize. So
it
once
is
you're made
part
aware,
of our
you catch yourself all the time.
Is there a culture out there that doesn't suffer from this? Is there?
We all suffer from it in different ways. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the thing is that, you know, the obviously we're, you know, being in the United States, we're aware of the problems in American cultures. But, you know, Asian cultures, which happen to do very well with sort of math and engineering and that sorts of things, they have their own theories about what they can and cannot do.
They're not innovative. They're not nearly as innovative as we are. I don't think Russia, when was the last time you bought a Russian product? You haven't.
But Russian,
besides oil.
Yeah, but I mean, and Russian engineers are, you know, some of the best in the world.
Oh, well, they're it's an amazing culture with mm-hmm. a very smart group of people, and they've had a very tough history, but I mean, there is so much potential in Russia, so much brain power.
There's so much potential all over the world.
Yeah.
And that's one of the really exciting things, too, is that, you know, ultimately what comes out of this in the long run is that we think about the value of a human being in a very different way. And we start to realize that, you know, when we, if you look at Africa or something like that, like, you know, yeah, okay, so you're supposed to feel bad and all these sorts of things, but like, just think about what a waste that is. Think about how much we're all losing out on by having, you know, that many hundreds of millions of people who spend their days, you know, like wrestling with diseases they don't need to wrestle with.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just such a waste of talent. And if we can, and that's the thing is that for all of us, I mean, you know, one of the ideas that we've really been taught to believe in is the idea of the lone genius. You know, that a yeah. guy goes into a room on his own and just like does something magical. And it's not, it's collaboration. You know, that's how these really great things happen. And that's the thing is that even now, like
everybody who's your hero had their own hero.
Yeah.
Everybody who's your hero that you look up to had their own network of support. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. Thomas Friedman, though, in 2 days ago in the New York Times, wrote an op-ed piece that I recommend people go to, or you don't have to really, but it's called I'll tell you about it. But it's called a College Online, mm-hmm. and how there is this there are a lot of different websites now. There's Coursera. It's called Coursera.org, mm-hmm. I think, where you can take not only a college course, you can get your college degree online for $100. Mm-hmm. By the way, you're being taught by the best teachers in the world, mm-hmm. Harvard, Princeton, Stanford, mm-hmm. MIT. And like you were saying, you can access free lectures on YouTube from, and I've done it. I mean, from the Stanford, and I listened to a Yale professor on political philosophy. I just wanted to brush up on it. Mm-hmm. And I'd sit here at night and watch 40-minute lectures from this brilliant Yale philosopher on political history and political philosophy, you know, and, like I didn't know all of it already. I was just checking.
Brian was actually teaching
the course.
Checking
to see if the guy even fucking knew what he was talking about. Anyway.
Send him some notes on
yeah. Yeah, man. I'm learning right now. My buddy was a pro boxer and a top of the food chain fighter. And I used to wrestle and do all that bullshit. But, you know, I love he kind of comes over and gives me free lessons at times. And it's amazing how fighting, boxing, for example, mm-hmm. is a system.
Yeah.
You got to learn. I wanted to hit mitts because I want to show him how hard I can hit mitts. He goes, you're not going to hit mitts, you yoker. I'm going to teach you where to stand. Your footwork sucks. Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're doing. Yeah. Everybody can hit mitts. So let's see you hit me when I'm moving and hitting you back. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I don't like this. and he literally just showed me, you know, he brought out these three sticks. I go, I don't want to learn stick fighting. And he goes, I'm not going to teach you stick fighting, asshole. I'm going to teach you where not to stand.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
By the way, and that brings me to another question. I wondered if you guys could talk on it. I always say that a lot of thinking is actually learning what not to think about.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's deletion. Right. It's a process of deletion. Mm-hmm. You know, Barbara DeAngelis, I heard her speak, and I don't know, she's some self-help guru. I don't like that stuff that much, but some of these people have something to say. And she said that a lot of us are trained to think that we're missing something. And in fact, what we probably need to do is get out of our own way. We need to lose something so something else can come in, so the real person can come in. I thought that was kind of a wise comment, because I think you could make the same analogy for being a thinker, learning how to think. Because mm-hmm. I was always taught that concentrate, think was mm-hmm. an active and very, yes, an active and severe process. Yes. And now, man, oh man, I didn't know how to fucking do that.
Now, that's one of the things is like, even when you're thinking really hard, people look at your face and they often think you're worried about something, right? And the thing is that like part of what's really fascinating is that Paul Ekman, who like studies facial expressions, and he's the guy that Lie to Me is based on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But he basically went and, you know, one of the big questions is, are facial expressions the same around the world? Or are they something that we learn culturally by watching movies and stuff like that? Like, oh, that's what an angry face looks like, right? Huh. And so, you know, the challenge is you have to find a group of people who have not been exposed to Hollywood culture, who have sure. not been exposed to all of that. Yeah. So he goes to the mountains of Papua New Guinea.
I was about to say.
Right?
I was literally about to say, did he go to like some obscure village in Papua New Guinea?
Yeah.
Where they wear dick sheaths? Fucking dick sheaths, which I definitely want to get. I just can't find one big enough. Hey, a fucking cock joke, and it's, wait a minute, how much time? But 50 minutes into it, and I come out with a cock. God, I'm so good. All right, keep going.
But so he, you know, he basically goes there and he like, you know, looks at what facial expressions they make, and they all match up with Western facial expressions. And he shows them photos of Westerners and says, you know, what is this person feeling? And they're like, oh, that person's angry. That person's da da da. So facial expressions are something that are really innate to us. Like we all have the same basic programmed facial expressions. They then become, you know, changed by culture.
So
like,
we all have the same facial expressions.
Basic facial expressions. Okay. But one of the fascinating things that he did is he identified all the muscles in the face, right? And then he said, oh, you know, angry is a combination of this muscle and this muscle being this, 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 and categorized it based on like each muscle.
Huh.
He then took electrodes and stuck electrodes in each one and was able to like basically stimulate the facial expression from outside, right? So he would like contract the right muscles, right? And when you have that facial expression, you then begin to feel that emotion.
There's no question, as an actor, I can tell you, and you guys know,
that
if you want to simulate emotion, just assume the position. Mm-hmm. Just start getting fucking angry, and you'll get angry. Yeah. Or start getting, you know, start charming
start
somebody.
Bawling,
yeah, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I remember I had to do a scene in my, I did this episode on, two episodes actually, on a little show called Entourage. You're welcome, America. And the audition was I had to be a crying wreck because Jeremy Piven's character is like, you know, what happened? And I'm like, they fired me. I got escorted out of the building. And he realizes there's a usurpation in his thing. And I was like, I can't go in there and cry. I'm going to have to, I got to work up to this. And my buddy looked at me and goes, just cry, dude. Just cry. My buddy Jeff Pierce. Yeah. He goes, just cry. Mm-hmm. I went, what? He goes, cry. And I was like, oh, okay. You just do it. You just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, if you think about like, if you're thinking that concentrating is this like process of being very, very serious, you're furrowing that brow. And so in some sense, you know, you're getting yourself into that state of worry, right? Which is a bunch of unnecessary thoughts in your head. Mm. And so you're no longer free to think, you know? And that's the thing is that, you know, there's a reason why your best ideas come to you in the shower, right? And Jonah Lehrer talks about this in his book, Imagine, right? Yeah. Because you're relaxed. And often, you know, that state of being calm. And so you look at those kids.
Well, you're also
school.
Not thinking about thinking.
Yeah.
You have
nothing on it. You know, I mean, that's the thing, too. If you're talking about taking things away in order to get, I mean, that's what we are trying to help people do is get rid of all the noise, all the mishigas that you tell yourself about whether you're good at something or bad or who's going more quickly than you are on this test or whatever you're seeing.
Yeah.
And just knowing that if you feel confused, that's normal because you're not an expert yet. And if you get stuck, that's normal.
Yeah.
Because, you know, none of those things are any sign of anything at all. And you just keep going and keep, you know.
It's so funny because I'm looking at you and you're a blonde chick and you're smart. I've never seen that.
Listen, anyway. I've had to deal with stereotypes in my whole
Well, no,
life.
But you have. I'm kidding, but I'm not kidding. In that, there's always that notion women aren't as good at
there's,
math. Women are ditzier, you know, all that shit that you probably had to fight through.
I mean, there are plenty of times when I tell people that I went to Harvard or that I do whatever and they're like, oh, really?
Yeah,
I'm
of
like,
course.
Yes, yeah, actually.
They're all the stereotypes. People look at my jawline and they're like, you're a pro athlete because my shoulders are
clearly
so broad.
Clearly some sort of hockey player.
I'm like, no, I'm an artist. And they're like, oh, well, of course you are. I've seen all your work. and I named my child after you. I'm sorry. Keep going. Keep going.
But so, yeah. And, you know, if you even think about if you think about like the kids who do really, really well in school, and we look at these kids and it seems so easy for them. And part of the reason why it's easy for them is because they're approaching it like it's easy, right? That leaves them in this state that is relaxed and open and ready to take the information in while they're sitting in class. Like they don't have to go home and do a bunch of extra work because they're just receptive, as opposed to the kids who are like busting their ass are often like, the reason why they're busting their ass is because they're busting their ass.
It's a tough thing. You know, sometimes the environment of school is so tough because there's so much social pressure and everything's going on.
You spend the entire day comparing yourself to everybody else around you. Yeah. So-and-so's hand goes up more quickly than yours in class and they know the answer
to the
question.
It's also just a
right
hostile
away.
Place, high school, you know?
Yeah.
It's such a scary place
jungle.
If you're a little bit of a nerd. But it seems, you know, whatever you want to call it, it is. I mean, people are, you know, there are cliques and it's, you know, and I think that a book like yours in technology, at least, is going to make smaller classes, even homeschooling, a reality. I mean, a bigger reality.
And I think ultimately what's going to happen is that everybody is going to have a classroom of one, right? Not necessarily that physically there are going to be no schools and 20 people won't get together. But for us, for me at least, what is really exciting is that what we're really teaching each student to do is be their own teacher. You are in charge of your education. You guide it. You control it. And then the thing is that, you know, the role of a teacher should be, you know, you think about how we use a teacher's intelligence right now, and it makes sense for an industrial age because you have one person in front of a group of 20 kids, right? And they're just delivering the same spiel year after year after year. And these are people with bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, PhDs. They're highly educated individuals. They're very intelligent. And is that a good use of their intelligence? No, because they're pitching basically this spiel, and the spiel is going to be too fast for some people, too slow for other people, and very few people is it going to be just right. Ultimately, I mean, if you...
Yeah, I've seen that. With even college lectures, it's a monologue that they've been doing for a long time.
Right. And that's based on technology. Like, the technology of that time dictated that, and we don't need that anymore. Because ultimately, you can have the student be in charge of teaching themselves. And then, you know, like, you know, if you think about, like, I know you did a lot of martial arts, like having the teacher comes in and he's able to see things that you can't see.
Right.
But mostly it's about you being in charge of your own learning.
Yeah. I mean, repetition and practice.
That's right.
All those things. Yeah. And then the teacher really gets to be specifically for going further, you know, discussion, debate, the kinds of things that are more valuable in that setting.
Yeah.
And that it's going to make it a much more enjoyable experience for the teacher as well, because they're really engaged and they're really like able to have the experience of dealing with each child and like giving, you know, feedback that is really specific to that child at that moment.
So then you're optimistic about the future in education.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that's, you know, part of for us is that, like, you know, we look at like this massive system and there's all this legislation and all that stuff. And it's, you know, that is like, how do you even deal with that? But we don't want to deal with that because ultimately we want to reach out to individuals and we want to say, listen, like, if you have kids right now, your kids will have kids of their own by the time the educational system has changed. You can't wait for that and you shouldn't wait for that, right? You can change the way that you approach your own education because you're an ongoing student for the rest of your life, and thereby the way that your children approach your education. Their education. And so that's the thing. And then it doesn't matter what school you're in to a large extent. I mean, you look at, like, you know, it's really fascinating because in the 1800s, before there was a formalized educational system, you had figures like Abraham Lincoln, right, who was born in a log cabin. He had 18 months of schooling, right? You know, and this was from, like, itinerant, like, guys wandering through the woods who said, I'm a tutor, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's arguably one of the smartest Americans.
I don't know why the guy had a southern accent, because wasn't this in
Illinois. Well, although he was born in Kentucky.
I'm a tutor.
He was born in Kentucky.
All right, but I just feel like you don't know how he speaks, and you're just throwing it.
I know, it's my bias, prejudice.
It could have been an English translator. I'm a tutor. The way they speak in Eton. Yeah.
But the, you know, or if you look at Booker T. Washington, right? Booker T. Washington was born a slave, and then when he was given his freedom and his liberty, he was rewarded with a job in a salt mine, which is arguably the worst occupation that has ever existed.
Jesus Christ.
But, you know, the guy had the tenacity and the drive to go out and get an education for himself, and he was able to get into a very good school. But even getting into that school was extremely hard, you know? And there's a book called 1776, which is about the American...
I read it.
It's a great book.
Read it.
But the...
There's another book by Jack London called Martin Eden. Have you read it?
No.
It's about him, a sort of autobiographical about him teaching himself how to write, but he had to educate himself first.
Yeah.
Living on $5. There's a really moving passage where his sister gives him $5. He starts to cry because he had no money.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful book about the what he determined to do, what he wanted to do, and he wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
But he knew nothing, so he had nothing to write about, so he started to educate himself.
I mean, Toni Morrison was really self-educated. A lot of
really?
These, yeah. I mean, a lot of these people who do amazing things are self-educated, and the thing is, that's what they've learned.
It's what I can't think of any subject that's more important to talk about or to sort of be involved in. You guys seem like you're really doing a service here. I'm definitely going to have you back on because I'm going to read the book, but, it's very exciting. I learned a lot just listening to all this because it just seems like that this is so desperately needed. I travel this country a lot and I see a lot of lost young people, but I also see a lot of people that are dying to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a human need.
That's the thing is that you know, when you learn something, the chemical that's released in your brain is dopamine. That is the same chemical that is released when you do cocaine. Okay, learning is addictive.
Do a lot of blow or what? No, I don't know. If you have no access to education,
if you can't
snort.
Find any books, yeah.
No, it's great, guys. You guys, I'm going to call you guys the cocaine twins.
Wonderful. That's going to help us reform education.
That's right. The book is called The Straight A Conspiracy, and it'll be available in 2 weeks. And I'm going to get a reading list from you as well, Hunter, and you, Katie. And I'm going to start putting it on my website. You can go to briancallen.com. Once again, this is brought to you by the xflexstand.com. And actually brought to you by me, because even if I wasn't sponsored, I'd be fucking doing this. And I love having people of substance like you guys on, so thanks for showing up. And we'll continue this exploration.
Fantastic.
All right, everybody. Brian Callen signing off. I wish I could say I was going to be in fucking Houston and Kansas City, but I think I'm doing a movie in New York for the whole month of June, so I had to cancel those dates. I will miss you. Much love.